From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center now presents part four in its series of conversations about modernism in its cultural and aesthetic effects on art, politics, and literature. The speakers are Harvey Gross, Stephen Marcus, James Olney, and Diane Leonard, each specializing in comparative modern literature. Harvey Gross, Stephen Marcus, and James Olney are scholars at the National Humanities Center. Diane Leonard teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. What about the issue of modernism as a malign or a benign cultural phenomenon? Has it been a good thing or a bad thing in terms of not only the artistic, the aesthetic, but at a cultural level?
Certainly I would think that modernism has produced, and Yeats, one of the greatest English poets, so how could that be bad? It has produced, or an Eliot. So in terms of actual artistic value, Stravinsky, Bartok, Schoenberg is still, I think, a question. But I don't think Stravinsky or Bartok are anything less than number one in anyone's hit parade as great, great artists. Bartok perhaps even more than Stravinsky. So I would think, and what modernism has produced in the arts, Picasso. If you just line these names up, how can you say that modernism has not been one of the great cultural epics?
I think there are two questions here. One is has modernism been a great creative? Has modernism been a period? Has modernism in the arts been a great creative period? And it seems to me that one has to unequivocally answer that question: yes, it's one of the great creative periods in the history of Western civilization, to be compared only with things like epochs like Romanticism and the Renaissance and the highest of the High Middle Ages and then the Greeks and so on. It is one of the great periods of creativity. That seems to me a very, very separate question from the value one places, as it were, morally or culturally, on this, insofar as we say that creative movements in the arts have effects, let's say, or consequences in people's lives, because there we come into a very, very complicated nexus.
It's always very complicated to make this nexus or connection between the art of an era and its cultural health. And there's some way, I suppose you could say, that a Kafka, Thomas Mann, a Schoenberg, the diagnosis of the culture that their work gives us is a very dark one indeed.
I would go on to say that there are several ways of looking at this problem, and you get a different set of answers, a different kind of answer depending on which way you look at it from. For example, if you say that exposure to modernist art, in an intense way, at least forces you to pay attention to what is being said and asserted there, then you become more aware of things, of certain kinds of things in the world about you, in language, in what you see and in what you hear, than you were before. So that your awareness and your sensibility, your awareness has been expanded in certain directions, and your sense of internal possibilities have been deepened, and your sense of the visual world and the oral world have been changed too. So you can say, okay, in terms of consciousness and perception, this represents an enrichment. If, on the other hand, you say, well, how has this affected your sense of the world and the possibilities of the world that you live in? By and large, the view of the social world and of human possibility that one takes away, let's say, from modernist art as it keeps developing into the postmodernist period is one that essentially grows darker and dimmer and more problematical, you know, and less happy as one goes along. That is to say, as one goes through the range of the figures and comes up toward the present, one sense of what the world is like becomes less happy, less satisfactory, more constrained, more, as it were, estranged than it was before. And what the consequences of that view of the world may be upon one's own consciousness and then upon one's own life are incalculable. I won't say good or bad, I will say they're simply incalculable. Because no one has yet arisen who has been able, since Plato, who has been able to tell us, you know, with any authority, what the effect of art upon life really is. Now, Plato and lots of people who agreed with him said the effect was direct, and therefore we banish poets from the Republic too. Because
Tolstoy said the same thing at the end of his life.
Exactly. And dictators are very sensitive. Let's say in the Soviet Union, and Hitler and people like that are very sensitive to artists, and they get rid of them. The independent ones pretty quickly too.
Is it possible for bad societies or societies with great flaws, societies that are aware of their own weaknesses, is it possible for them to produce great art?
Well, sure. I don't think there's, if I may say so, I don't think there's any doubt about that. Just think of classical Greece, a society which based on slavery, you know, and so on, and look at what it produced. That is to say, there is no, I myself feel that there's no necessary correlation between the structure or character of a society and the kind of cultural works that it produces. This is a very open question. This doesn't mean that you can't read back from works of art into society and say how works of art were produced and what their relation to society was. But I don't think there's any formula for being able to say in advance, you know, that either a bad society will produce a bad works of art or a good society will produce good works of art. The situation of both is much too complicated for that.
Could we say, though, that a good society is that society which has produced good works of art? Would we agree with that or not?
No.
I don't think Greek society was a good society. It had slaves.
Or Russia in the 19th century. Right. A completely repressive society, and yet it produced the greatest novelists of the age.
But is a society identical with its political system? I mean, these are very complex questions.
Well, I think then that we have to ask a question which is outside, as it were, literally of our range of discussion. What does one mean by a good society?
That's right.
There was a tendency toward the end of the 19th century, and a tendency that some of the early modernists themselves took over, to identify a good society with a society that produced good art. That is to say, there was a kind of circular set of reasoning there. If good art was produced, it had to be a good society. Now, it seems to me that is not the case at all. And indeed, if one reads a figure we haven't talked about yet, but who is a very important early modern figure, Marx has some very interesting reflections, you know, upon how it is that very bad societies, let's say, produce great art, and how there is no guarantee, let's say, that a society in the future, let's say, it's a totally equalitarian society, will produce great works.
There's always the added fillip to this discussion that the very fact of repression will make writers and artists ingenious in avoiding, say, censorship as in Russia, and in a sense stimulate a creativity that might not otherwise have been stimulated. So this, as Stephen says, there's no way to fathom this question.
And a correlative fact is when Wayne asks whether a flawed society can produce great art, whether great art can come out of a flawed society, frequently in modernist period in particular, other periods perhaps too in ancient Greek literature, the great art is partly concerned with criticism of the flawed society. I mean, Eliot certainly does not think in any of his great poems that the society that he's writing about is an unflawed society.
So it isn't. It isn't so much the society itself or the social conditions; it's how the artist reacts to that and what he passes on as a legacy. Is that the important thing?
No, I mean, you again try to answer your question by saying that, again, it leads one to as it were, almost a totalogous answer, which is that no art has ever been produced except by flawed societies, since there have only been flawed societies.
The only unflawed society is the one in the Republic that Plato imagines, where the without art is not there.
Right. Without art, right.
There would be no art.
That's right.
There'd be no need for it. How could tragedy be possible without the flawed society? I mean, what is tragedy about, in a sense? But the collision of the individual with Antigone, say, with an unjust society.
And that's why Plato was trying to imagine a society that had nothing to do with the tragic. I mean, it's the Republic that he creates. There's no place for the tragic vision in there at all.
Well, then, what are the great social concerns, or the great artistic concerns, the great flaws that the modernists have addressed themselves to? Is it possible to provide an overview of that kind of question?
Sure. The loss of religion is one.
The loss of faith.
Loss of faith and right. The loss of
the loss
belief.
Of the loss of transcendent value, or the loss of a transcendent
the,
realm.
The central subject of modern certainly art.
That would be one. It would seem to me the other is the threat to the individual, that individuality is, by virtue of modern social circumstances or cultural circumstances, continually threatened. Yeah.
Does that account in part for the very intensity, the focus on the individual by the modern artist?
Oh, in part. Not entirely, but in part. Yes, and it seems to me that what so many of the modern artists are writing about is that this cherished sense of individuality is being threatened by the very forces which originally created that individuality, mm-hmm. namely the great, powerful, material, technical, economic advances that have distinguished Western, that made Western society what it was. Those are the forces that were behind the creation of Western individuality, and they're the very same forces that, in their own development, threaten to overwhelm and destroy it. And this, it seems to me, is one of the great points of centrality of modern art. I mean, this is where they really, you know, this is one of the places where they really found their subject, and where they really were able to speak in a way which is comparable to the very greatest artists of the past.
To me. The one great thing that all of the modernists oppose is our tendency to sleep through life and to not live fully and to not have an awareness of our experiences. And if I could find one common denominator that I think all of them converge upon, it would be that. It ties in with what Stephen Marcus has just said about individualism, but to my mind it's more the proper focus than simply individualism.
These three things that have been mentioned, I think the great theme of the loss of faith and the cherished ideal of the individual in the sense that the possibility of individualism is rapidly vanishing. And then third, the insistence that we must not sleep through life. I think all of those demonstrate that modernism has its roots in Romanticism, because these are all the themes and the great original themes of Romanticism. And all through the 19th century, there's the anguish sense that faith is being lost, the possibility of faith is being lost. And it's further developed in modernist literature, but it's the same theme, obviously.
There's also a fourth I would add to that heritage of Romanticism, the burden of civilization and encroaching civilization. As in the Romantic period, it was already clear that industrialism was going to be a threat.
Yes.
And in the 20th century, we have the atom bomb. and so that the possibility of man annihilating himself through his learning the secrets of nature is certainly part of this insight.
Very much. I do think one has to go back to it, and back to something so simple, you know, as, let's say, Wordsworth's marvelous line, "Have I not reason to lament what man has made of man," you know, in which he's using reason in a very complicated way there. You know, what has reason done? You know, it's done unreasonable things. You know, and the the place of reason, you know, in art or in culture or in modernist life, is in fact to make us aware in new ways of some of the things that reason has done to destroy itself and to injure mankind. So I agree with what James said entirely, that although there is every reason to establish and to insist upon the coherence of modernism, there is at the same time every reason to see it as being continuation of that great change in consciousness that began at the end of the 18th century.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to part four of the Center's series of conversations about cultural and aesthetic modernism and its impact on politics, art, and literature in the 20th century. The speakers are Diane Leonard, Stephen Marcus, Harvey Gross, and James Olney, each of whom teaches and writes about comparative modern literature. Diane Leonard is on the faculty of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Harvey Gross, Stephen Marcus, and James Olney are scholars at the National Humanities Center.
It occurs to me that what Stephen was saying a moment ago about the very forces that brought into, at the beginning of the Romantic period, the very forces that brought into being the great ideal of individualism now threaten individualism, the technological changes and so on, is perfectly dramatized in a film like Modern Times. Where the technological forces are simply crushing the individual. And that's what Chaplin Shirley is saying in that film.
And I think that one aspect of this technology that the artists are addressing themselves to is this kind of mind control, which it seems to me probably the artist finds even more threatening than the atom bomb. I mean, at least the bomb is something that's, the threat of it sort of penetrates through that thick skin of habit. But I think there is a sense that all of us are becoming increasingly sort of machine-like, robot-like, partly because of the technological and cultural conditions of the time. When I think about that, I'm not sure that we couldn't posit some sort of relation between what's happening in our society and what perhaps isn't happening right now in our art.
And those who have complained about the malign effect of modernism, the phenomena of the 60s, brought this to the attention of Daniel Bell in his book, The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism. Yet wasn't the 60s, in a sense, indicative, Diane, of what you just said, namely increasing sense of frustration with a society that seemed ever encroaching on the mind, on the individual?
I agree, except I think that what happened in the 60s, I agree with you, but I think that what happened in the 60s was not so much an expression of modernism, but a demonstration of the way that the forces which modernism was protesting against have a power to defeat whatever protests against them. That is, if you take something like the counterculture, for example, the way the counterculture was immediately commoditized, capitalized, sold, you know, and made part of the economic system was one of the wonders of the world to behold. Because here you had a movement which began with what? A style. You know, very modernistic, really. That is, a change in style and dress and the way one walked and the way one talked and, you know, and the way one ate, you know, and things like that. And one suddenly felt that a whole culture battened on this, immediately domesticated it, assimilated it, and tamed it. And so, within, 18 months, policemen had long hair, were wearing jeans, that is, the counterculture had gotten into the pores of the entire system. And what started out as a protest, in the traditional romantic, modernistic way, it was immediately assimilated and neutralized and lost all its power of protest, entirely. And you saw it on television every night, and not merely on the news, but as part of the programs that one saw. Now, this is something, you see, which the modernist artists had an inkling of, but didn't have to face. It seems to me that they would be that domestication would be that rapid and that thorough as it was. I can't imagine even an Eliot or a Joyce making headway against power of that kind.
Or having conceived of us being turned on his head in that way.
Right.
Designer genes, a nice illustration of that appropriation.
But certainly the surface techniques of modernism have been exploited. Discontinuity, the quick cut in the movie, for instance, is
on television.
Right. The modern is a modernist device or a technique. A certain kind of movie music comes right out of Schoenberg because you get this Schoenbergian music whenever there's something tense or dangerous or angst-causing, and so you see where the culture has taken elements of modernism and turn them, in a sense, against what modernism was originally striving for. I suppose Hegel would simply say that's cunning of reason.
I think that's exactly what he'd say.
Die List der Vernunft, operating. Getting history gets its way back on people.
Except Hegel thought that the story of history was the story of freedom.
Yeah.
And what we're talking about is what the modernists wanted to believe in some sense that at least through their art, that story was being carried on. But what we've been talking about now is the opposite of that, you know, is a lot of unfreedom. That is to say, the way critical statements or protests are rendered ineffective by the kind of postmodern machinery in culture that we see everywhere around us.
We might ask, I suppose, what comes next? Is postmodernism the next development, or is postmodernism simply a corruption of modernism? My friend Ihab Hassan argues that postmodernism is new, refreshing, a way out, fun, and so on. But the question is it or is it simply modernism in its final death agony? Or is it too soon to see? I mean, this brings us back to the whole question of modernist self-consciousness. To ask this question would be unthinkable except in a modernist context.
Yeah, surely it's too soon to see, but that doesn't mean that one can't say something about it or speculate about it. But I would think that postmodernism, what is called postmodernism, is really a very logical development out of modernism as we've been talking about it. In the sense, for example, the notion that you say Ihab Hassan says that postmodernism is fun, a lot of fun. The notion of play and to a certain degree irresponsible play. Postmoderns would say that they have no responsibility in the play that they exercise with literature. That seems to me as an extension and perhaps a perversion by excessive extension of certain trends in modernism.
I believe postmodernism stands in somewhat the same relationship to modernism that realism does to romanticism, that some forms of realism do to romanticism, such as Flaubert, the taking over of romantic devices and parodying them because they had become worn out and dead and you couldn't use them any longer. We've come into the era, as Harvey Gross just pointed out, of schlock modernism. I mean, these things have degenerated into trite cliches, and it seems to me postmodernist literature essentially is sort of clearing the ground now for something new and positive by exactly parodying and laying bare the devices of modernism. I think we're going to move now into a new era, maybe where we'll move back towards, to paraphrase Mukhachovsky, back towards a structured pole now. I can't imagine what it would be. I don't mean politically. I mean in terms of aesthetic norms.
Well, I think that I would myself have no powers of prediction here. But it would seem to me that modernism coincided with the last great phase, the last great triumphant phase of liberal bourgeois capitalism. That is to say, it was the cultural arm of the 20th century form of liberal bourgeois capitalism. And we've now entered upon a phase in which it looks as if that form of capitalism is beginning to come apart. That is to say, it is no longer triumphant, it is no longer unchallenged, it is no longer regnant without, you know, without deep inner divisions and doubts. And it seems to me that whatever form of art or culture we have is going to be an expression, as it were, of that liberal bourgeois capitalism as it enters this new phase, which is not a phase of triumph and not a phase of, as it were, holding the world in command, but a phase in which it is deeply divided within itself, in which certain parts of it begin to decompose and come apart, and in which it is experiencing profound challenges both from within and from without. That is to say, the notion of bourgeois democracy, you know, which is what the modernists could bounce off so easily because it was such a powerful idea, is itself no longer an unchallenged or unproblematical idea. And whatever form of culture we have coming out of this, it seems to me, will in some way be expressive of the crisis, you know, that this particular culture is currently going through.
You did say earlier that it's a gloomy progression.
It's gloomy. It is gloomy. It is not the 19th century view of progress.
No.
Laid out a wonderful program for both society and for the arts. Now, that particular view seems not to have come true and to be unfortunately disproved and bankrupt. And although I'm not saying that the view is simply a reverse one of regress, you know, or of going backwards, it is not simply unimpeded or a linear progress at all.
What seems to be happening now that I think we can mark with some certainty is the tendency to repeat. That is, the 60s repeated the surrealist and Dada impulses. The 50s expressionist, de Kooning, is in a sense goes back to the expressionism of the late 19th century. Now we have neorealism in painting. We have a neoclassicism in music. And these are occurring in terms of decades rather than in terms of epoch. So we now speak of the 20s and 30s and the 40s and the 50s and 60s as self-enclosed cultural entities almost, and which bespeaks an enormous acceleration of the historical process. But this business of repetition that seems to be going on now probably will continue till the end of the century. And I think this is a phenomenon that might bear watching. What does this indicate? I'm not sure what it indicates. But it seems to indicate a certain amount of exhaustion and tiredness.
Harvey Gross teaches comparative literature at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. James Olney is a professor of English at North Carolina Central University. Stephen Marcus was chairman of the Department of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. Diane Leonard is head of the Curriculum in Comparative Literature at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Professors Gross, Olney, and Marcus are scholars at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The Center would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.